Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? From Little Rock, Arkansas, the Salty Dogs' feel-good country music has been hailed by critics and fans alike and has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces as well as HBO's Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has performed with the late bluesman Frank Frost, bluesman Robert Nighthawk's son, the late Sam Carr, and the late Willie Foster. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight our featured artist is painter Vicki Hendricks Cyber Morgan with this piece right over here, which is entitled Truckin' South and is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Vicki at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? After earning a degree in Russian and East European studies, Cindy Dees joined the U.S. Air Force and became the youngest female pilot in its history. She flew supersonic jets, VIP airlift, and the C-5 Galaxy, one of the world's largest cargo planes. She also worked part-time gathering intelligence. During her military career, she traveled to 42 countries on 5 continents, was detained by the KGB and East German secret police, got shot at, flew in the first Gulf War, met her husband, and amassed a lifetime's worth of war stories. Cindy has turned many of her experiences into novels of military romance and suspense. Cindy's hobbies include professional Middle Eastern dancing, Japanese gardening, and medieval reenacting. Winner of a Golden Heart and Holt Medallion for writing, Cindy is a 2-time winner of the prestigious Rita Award for romance fiction, 2-time winner of the RT Book Review's Best Harlequin Romantic Suspense Novel of the Year, is a Romantic Times Lifetime Career Achievement nominee, and a Walden Books best-selling author. Her 45th romance novel was recently published, and she's looking forward to the release of her first epic fantasy novel with co-author Bill Flippin in 2015. Originally from Michigan, Cindy has been a Southerner for 22 years and currently lives in Dallas, Texas. Tonight, Cindy takes us up with her into the skies in A Chance to Fly. Ladies and gentlemen, Cindy Dees.
I had just completed my training at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where I was the first and only woman pilot in a squadron of 450 men, flying the C-5, a huge cargo plane that's bigger than a Boeing 747 and one of the largest aircraft on Earth. It was my very first overseas flight in a C-5, and I got to pull the late shift, babysitting the autopilot on an all-nighter flight to Europe. At about 4 a.m., the flight engineer, sitting at his panel behind me, announced out of the blue, I can't take this anymore. I have to go wake up the other engineer. Startled, I replied, is something wrong? Are you tired? We can talk, or I can pull up some music on the radios. He answered, no, no, that's not it. I've just never been in an airplane with the woman at the controls. It's freaking me out. I responded sympathetically, I know exactly how you feel. It scares the hell out of me to think that I'm on an airplane with a male chauvinist pig at the engineer's panel. I learned that night, after talking out this man's fears with him and sharing my flying credentials with him, that sometimes your greatest critics can become your greatest supporters if you give them a chance. You see, most of what I know about life, I learned in airplanes. You could say flying is in my blood. Both my grandfather and father were private pilots, and my grandfather owned a small airplane that I spent many hours in, sitting on telephone books, yearning for the day when my feet would reach the rudder pedals. The first serious lesson I learned in an airplane at the ripe old age of 3 is that when you pick up the radio at a major international airport and tell a superhero you need him to come quick, Batman does not, in fact, come. When I could reach those rudder pedals and see out the airplane's windshield without the telephone books, I did learn how to fly, and I earned my own pilot's license. The exhilaration of watching the earth fall away beneath me, of entering the realm reserved for birds and gods, changed me. Flying made me feel special, as if I had secret, invisible wings of my own. Flying taught me to be daring. And so I dared to leave high school at 15 and go to a university. I abandoned my secret wings for boys and cars and college. I traded imagination for intellectual pursuits, searching for a career that would bring me limitless wealth and not take very much work. I graduated with a degree in Russian and East European studies and aspirations of becoming a spy. But it turns out the CIA feels most 19-year-olds should ripen on the vine a bit more before coming to work for them. That was when my siren, flying, called once more. She dared me to become an Air Force officer and go to Columbus, Mississippi for Air Force pilot training. My first day there, a colonel stood in front of my class, me and 62 guys, and told us to look at the person on either side of us. He informed us that one of those people would not make it through the next year of training. In my case, he was wrong. The fellow on my left quit pilot training to spend more time with his young family. The guy on my right, who became my best friend, died 10 months later in a fiery mid-air collision I was unfortunate enough to witness. His death taught me an important lesson about daring. With daring comes risk, and with risk comes the possibility of failure. If you're lucky, failure doesn't cost a life, but luck is a fickle goddess who delights both in giving and in taking away. I graduated from pilot training, and now my wings were visible on my uniform for all the world to see. I headed for Washington, D.C. and Andrews Air Force Base, where I learned how to smile pleasantly when passengers asked me, "When did the Air Force start putting flight attendants on business jets?" I would point at my wings politely and tell them, "These are wings. They cost $1 million and the life of my best friend. I'll be your pilot today, gentlemen." After my assignment at Andrews, I moved to Dover Air Force Base to fly the giant C-5. I was the first woman pilot in my squadron. None of the 450 men in it had ever worked with or for a woman before. Let the record show, men do gossip as much as women. They talk about sex, sports, and money, almost exclusively and in that order. And most guys are family men at heart. They may talk a good line at 18 or 20 years of age, But they eventually settle down and want spouses, kids, and lawns to mow. Oh, and never tell your coworkers which men's cologne turns you on. They will bathe in the stuff just to mess with you. On my second C5 flight, another Europe junket, we were flying over France and were given a new route clearance. The other pilots couldn't find the route because the French language can be spelled nothing like it sounds. I took control of the radios, and even though I speak French, I spoke in English, which is the language of all aviation in the world. I asked the air traffic controller for the route clearance with a promise that I would get it right this time and get out of his hair. A by then very grumpy French air traffic controller grudgingly gave me the new route. As I found it on a map and programmed the flight computers, the controller announced, "Air France, you have a U.S. military jet opposite direction and closing. He's 2,000 feet above you and is no factor." The Air France DC-9, which is a large 130-passenger airplane, radioed back, "We have the big green ugly airplane in sight." In our cockpit, the crew squawked, "Hey, that's true, but hey." The air traffic controller then radioed me, "U.S. Mil, you have an Air France DC-9 opposite direction, 2,000 feet below you." I scanned outside, found the airplane, and radioed back, "Roger, we have the light twin aircraft in sight." This was the moment in which I learned just how important it is for all young people to study a foreign language. The French controller and the Air France pilots took off speaking over the radios in rapid French about those bleep bleep Americans who think they own the skies over Europe and how they should all be thrown out on their derrieres. After this vitriolic little exchange, I popped up on the radio in my fluent Parisian French and said, "Yes, and sometimes those bleep bleep Americans also speak French." The radios went dead silent. And into the ensuing thunderous void, an anonymous British voice came up over the radios and said, "Bravo, Yank." It's good to have allies. It was also in the skies over Europe that I learned the best way to infuriate a fighter pilot. We got intercepted for training purposes by an American fighter pilot over Germany who came up on the radios and announced, "I can do all kinds of stuff you can't. Watch this." He then executed an intricate series of barrel rolls, literally and very illegally, in circles around our airplane, to which we responded, "Oh yeah? Watch this." Our C5 continued droning along perfectly straight and level. After a minute or so, we radioed, "What do you think of that?" "You didn't do anything," the stick jockey replied scornfully, to which my fellow pilot replied, "Are you kidding? I walked back into the crew rest area, stretched my legs, relieved my bowels, and poured myself a cup of hot coffee." Sometimes the quiet, steady guy is the one who gets things done, and not the loud, flashy guy. With the advent of the first Gulf War, the C5 community went into high gear. We flew more hours per month than the RAF bomber pilots in World War II, and flew about 115% of our maximum wartime capacity. Perhaps the most important thing I learned during that challenging time is that people are willing to die for three things, and three things only: their family, their country, and their buddy in the foxhole beside them. When the chips are down, nobody cares about gender or color or ethnicity. They only want to know that I can shoot a gun, do my job, and help get them home safely. The crucible of war strips away all of the meaningless crap and leaves only raw truths exposed. Mom, apple pie, and my brothers in arms. Those are true. Those matter. After a reduction in forces involuntarily sent my husband and I into civilian life, I dared to write a book. My mother bet me a dollar I couldn't do it. And I may be a wee bit competitive, and I might have taken that bet. So far, I've published 45 novels, many of them having to do with the lessons I learned while flying, and most daring to say that love conquers every obstacle life can throw at us. Maybe if more people got a chance to fly, to watch the earth slip away beneath them, and to visit the halls of angels, we would all be better off for it. Human beings are more alike than they are different. We all have the capacity to dream, to dare, and to love. And we all have secret wings that make us daring, magical beings if we can but learn to see them.
Thank you so much, Cindy Dees, for being on Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. In your story, you tell us that it was you and 62 guys in your Air Force pilot training in Mississippi, and then you and 450 guys in your squadron at Dover Air Force Base, correct? So are there some stories that you can share about being the only woman surrounded by all these men?
Oh, sure. Where to begin? There are two things that I learned pretty quickly working with groups of men. One is, and I will only attribute it to fighter pilots, but I'm told it works for other sorts of groups of men. Some of the ladies in here can share with us. If you have one fighter pilot in a room, he has 100% of a normal human being's intelligence. If you put two fighter pilots in the room, between the two of them, they have one normal human being's intelligence. If you have 10 of them in a room, they're working at 10%, and if there's 100 of them, they're working at 1%. And so large groups of men get progressively more challenging to work with. The second thing I learned pretty early on was to stake out my turf. Everywhere I went, I was the first woman pilot they'd ever had in that particular unit. And nobody really knew what to expect of me, so they would test me a little. And the military has a bit of a tradition of pranks. So my very first trip, in fact, the one in the C-5 where the engineer told me he was afraid of me and that I was going to kill him, we landed in Germany, and the crew informed me with great seriousness, they actually did it straight-faced, that the new co-pilot is supposed to buy beer for the entire crew. And a C-5 crew is typically around 20 to 22 people. So this is a pricey proposition pretty quickly. And it so happened that the NFL football playoffs were going at the time we landed. And so we couldn't get the NFL football games in our hotel in downtown Frankfurt. So we rented a hotel room on the military base to pile into one hotel room, and all 20 of us, to watch some football games before we went to bed. And I was duly sent out to buy beer for the entire crew. And something that I did learn that day is that it takes two Marines to shake an entire unopened case of beer so hard that the cans warp, and then to carry it upstairs for you. And it turns out Marines are very happy to carry unopened, shaken cases of beer to Air Force crews. And about $2,000 damage to the hotel room later, and finishing mopping down the walls, we finally got into crew rest.
The story of the Frenchman on the radio is great, where they don't realize that you understand French until you let them know that you speak French. What other languages do you speak? And then have you been able to use that to your advantage in other situations as well?
Well, I'm fluent in Russian and German as well, and I speak enough Romanian and Polish to get into big trouble. I was a spy for about 10 minutes. Don't be terribly impressed. There was a program, and it's now declassified, I can talk about it, where diplomatic flights into the United States by Russian aircraft had American pilots on board as escorts. And we all had to speak Russian. And we were ostensibly there to help them with the radios and maps and translate when they got onto the ground. And I was young. I was 22 when I got into the program. And we discovered very quickly that Russian pilots will tell a young enough, dumb enough blonde anything. And So I spoke wonderful Russian, but it didn't seem to dawn on them that I was going to understand the things they told me. And they would get, for example, there was a new radio system that came onto the airplane, and no American had seen it. And I strolled into the cockpit, and I looked at it, and I looked over at the navigator, and I went, "Ooh, do you know what all those dials and switches do? I could never remember all of that." And he puffed up and said, "Well, yes, Cindy, this does that, that does that." And he proceeded to tell me everything about the radio. So I went back in the back and drew a picture and labeled everything. And handed it over to my local intelligence officer. And it was interesting that the Russians, as a group, just couldn't seem to wrap their brain around the fact that I could understand them and speak their language, even though I'd made no secret of it. It turned out to be very useful. French turned out to be a very useful language around the world, and I think Spanish is probably a very useful language now for travel as well. Pretty much everywhere I went, I could talk to somebody.
And you speak Spanish as well?
No. Oh. No, I suck at Spanish.
I love that your mom dared you a dollar to write your first book. And of course, 45 books later, you're still writing. Are there other things that she dared you to do that you took her up on?
You know, honestly, probably the single largest thing she ever dared me to do was to not be bored. When I was about 9 years old on a summer vacation, school had been out a couple of weeks, and I was an only child. I didn't have brothers and sisters that she could toss me out the back door with. And I approached her, and she was a high school teacher. She, of course, laid unconscious for her entire summer recovering. And I approached her and said, "Mom," you know how kids whine, "Mom, I'm bored." And she looked at me and she said, "You are too bright and too talented and too creative ever to be bored in your life. If you choose to be bored, that's your problem, not mine. Go forth and entertain yourself." And I have to say, I've been doing so ever since.
Yeah, I like that. I might have to use that with my kids.
Yes.
All right, well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
How soon after your military career began did they start to see more women in the ranks as pilots?
Well, there are only 1% of the pilot force is allowed to be female even to this day. So of the 20,000 or so Air Force pilots, there were never more than about 200 of us, and it continues to be about that way. They're letting women do more now. They'll let them fly fighters now. And in fact, I was offered the opportunity to be one of the first women flying combat jets. But by then I had gotten old enough that I realized my mortality and I was married and wanted to live to an old age. So I declined.
As a spy, seeing combat, dealing with all the military men you've had to deal with, and this little audience scared you?
Well, you know, most people will say public speaking is the scariest thing any human being does. You all look fabulous in your underwear, by the way.
What I don't understand is why somebody with the history and the credentials that you have, having fought and flown with the United States military planes, why in the world that tonight you have not had a flyover from the Air Force Thunderbirds?
Well, with sequestration, they're just getting back in the air, so they've been grounded for about the last year. We did have a nice flyover at our wedding. It was a wedding gift. The local F4 unit where I grew up gave us quite an air show. And we also, the local hardware store owner is a balloonist, and we had 80 balloons go over our wedding as well.
You said your mom really didn't dare you to do a lot, but she did dare you for a dollar to write a book. There had to be more backstory to that. What kind of led up to that bet? That's what I wanted to know.
My mother is a writing professor. She was a high school English teacher, and then she got a PhD in English and taught writing at Michigan State University, where I grew up. Writing was her thing. Being a typical teenager, I was never getting near it with a 10-foot pole. I always loved reading. And I was an avid reader. I was going home on leave to visit and had read a book on an airplane and got off and flung it at my mother and informed her that it was terrible and even I could write something better. And that's where the $1 bet came from. And once I tried writing, I realized that in my own family, my mother's family is from Kentucky, and they are huge storytellers. They used to play a card game called Euchre. and they would sit around the table and tell stories all night long. But I didn't realize it for storytelling. It was just part of the fabric of my life that the family told jokes and told tales and spun yarns. And so pretty quickly after I sat down and started writing, I realized I had that in my past and fell in love very quickly with writing. I would do it even if I weren't published.
And you told me earlier that there was a period of time that you had to wait before you could start publishing. Can you tell the audience about that?
I had a high-level security clearance, and they don't allow you to publish with one of those clearances active. And they take 7 years to expire. And the theory is that I might accidentally reveal something that I don't know to be national security related. And so they just put a moratorium on all publishing for the 7 years.
So how many books had you written by the time that the 7 year, do you remember?
Yeah, I think I was on about number 6 by then. I wasn't in a big hurry. I knew that I couldn't publish during that time. Most of those books will stay under my bed where they belong. I only published a couple of those.
So how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Cindy Dees, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. You can find out more about Cindy, her life, and her books at cindydees.com. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Don't go speeding when you're driving through this town, 'cause Johnny will shut you down. He'll haul you downtown. And old John Austin, he is talking to himself. He's walking around, and he's the talk of the town. It's another day, another day in a small town. Town saying, Another day in a small town. Another day in a small town.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.